It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 3.0.
No funny tagline this week. We're just asking you to donate money or blood to the Red Cross. You can go to redcross.org or text Red Cross to 90999 to help with the Japanese relief efforts.
Yeah. So I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Tobias Bekel. Welcome
to the
show.
Thanks for having me.
And you are obviously the author of Crystal Rain, Ragamuffin, Sly Mongoose, Coal Protocol, and the upcoming Arctic Rising.
Yeah.
Which, well, upcoming in a year upcoming. Well,
yeah.
11 months. So it's almost, but which we're looking forward to.
And start our clocks.
Yeah. Mine's already set. I got the calendar, you know, no. So I guess this kind of sprung off of, we've been having this ongoing discussion first on blogs, and then we had an episode about it, about the intersection of colonialism and science fiction.
Okay.
And that's kind of why I wanted to really bring you on, because a lot of your work does deal with colonialism in very obvious ways and in allegorical ways and so forth. So I guess the big question to start with is, how do you see colonialism and science fiction sort of intersecting in today's market? And do you see that maybe there is some kind of a change in how it is addressed by SF authors today?
Well, certainly one thing that has impacted it has been a quite literal colonization narrative, which is of going off to colonize other worlds. And I think that also a lot of science fiction takes a look back and harkens back to the industrial age, that moment where we kind of developed science as a important player in society. And, you know, we went through the Enlightenment and those sort of revolutions hit, particularly the Industrial Revolution. And I think that mix of colonialism and the Industrial Revolution, which created a sort of literature that looked at how science and mechanics, you know, affected the world around us, as it should, meant that we also carried over some of that narrative of colonization, because in the 1800s, that's what the great nations were sort of preoccupying themselves with doing. And so a lot of writers, I think, turned back to looking at what that narrative of sort of colonizing the Africa, the dark continent, quote unquote, and basically put that in space in a lot of places. And it sort of carries over as a theme in a lot of empire, what I call empire science fiction, that continued on all throughout into the 1950s and 60s. And one thing you also saw some of is the sort of white man's burden sort of narrative, which I kind of reject, obviously. And so to see it implicitly buried as a underlying assumption in a lot of fiction that, you know, people from Earth would go and bring enlightenment to sort of, you know, other alien races was very interesting. And there's always an assumption that, you know, if there was to be a first contact situation, that there's some natural element about, you know, us, whoever that us is, that makes us superior to the others. And of course, that's just because, you know, you don't want to read depressing fiction about, you know, the Earthmen who got their asses handed to them by a superior alien race. But on the other hand, the fact that so much of it shies away from that and doesn't try to engage with that, I think was is a missed opportunity. And so when I read a lot of science fiction as a kid, I'm biracial. I look white, but my father was Caribbean. And my background is, you know, Caribbean. Half my family comes from, you know, the South Caribbean, and the other half comes from England. So I kind of identify simultaneously with all sorts of different groups, and I don't feel uncomfortable doing it. And as a child, there reached a point where I suddenly realized that I wasn't the heroes in science fiction weren't me at some point. They or the heroes were the bad guys were my friends. You know, we were the other. And that was one of those moments where I kind of got sort of unconsciously rejected from science fiction. My chosen genre kind of reared itself up and spat me out. And it was kind of a disconcerting moment as a young reader, because you tend to have fewer filters at first going in, and then you read and you read and you read and you start to pick up on this zeitgeist. And there reached this point where I read a book that had Caribbean characters in it in a science fiction novel who were playing a major role in the narrative. And I suddenly thought to myself, my goodness, how come this is hitting me over the head with its newness, and what is this I'm feeling? And I suddenly realized that all the other stuff that I'd read previously to that, pretty much, whenever I'd encountered people who came from my part of the world or from other parts of the world where I was meeting lots of people, we were like non-entities. And that really kind of struck me and kind of had a scales from the eyes moment there, where I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, most of this fiction really, really kind of others me and others the people I consider, you know, family and friends and countrymen. And that was a moment where I started to think a lot about the colonialism in science fiction as a narrative.
And do you see that there is some change now? Is that changing? I know you and Nalo Hopkinson definitely write a lot about these kinds of characters, but is there still, in your opinion, this kind of just mostly just an absence?
Well, you know, it's everyone has their own sort of spear that they're carrying. And so, of course, growing up in a small nation that is sort of dominated by other colonial nations with a deep history of that, this is something I pick up on more readily, just as someone who is maybe disabled would pick up on things that people are screwing up in terms of representation of ability in fiction. You know, we all have our kind of perceptive filters, and it's you know, this all makes me sound like I walk around thinking about colonialism all day when I try to write fiction, but that's not quite the case. But it is one aspect where I think, you know, there are opportunities to tell more stories. And there are authors who tell more of these stories. I think I'm thinking of some older writers who've you know, sort of pilloried and turned things upside down on their head. And if you look at some of the really great masters, one of the really cool things they do is they do have a little bit more awareness than other people of their time of some of these troubling questions. You know, one of the things I liked about Heinlein's, I think it's Destination Moon. Is that Destination Moon? Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Oh.
Is the he's doing an early American revolutionary narrative with the people of the moon trying to get away from Earth. But for someone who grew up in a post-colonial country that has just recently achieved independence, it resonated very strongly with me, the, you know, sort of relationship that the moon has with the Earth and that. And I think that I don't know if Heinlein intentionally was thinking about, you know, colonialism as such. He was thinking more about early American revolutionary, but that in and of itself is one reason why I'm fascinated by early American history, because I think for the first 50 to 100 years, America was a post-colonial nation and had to deal with many of the same things that nations today are trying to deal with. It took America about 100 years to kind of put together its own destiny, you know, right. Until the late 1800s. You know, America is considered by most of the world as a sort of backward nation that can kind of defend itself, but it's not really a global player necessarily. And Americans themselves have that opinion. And it's not until like really in the late 1800s and right around like really World War One, where it kind of everything kind of kicks off and America's kind of like, yeah, we're in this, you know, and we're major players. And so like I think a lot of, you know, one of the criticisms people tell me is like, well, if you're interested in post-colonial fiction, isn't all American fiction post-colonial fiction? And I was like, well, no, but American fiction from the 1700s to the late 1800s actually has a lot of those components that I mark as post-colonial fiction. I'm very concerned about its relationship with the colonial powers of Britain and France, very concerned with trying to step up to the global plate, trying to find out how it plays off. You know, America obtained its independence by playing England off against France. And you see things like that, like, you know, in Cuba when they were playing off Russia versus the US, you know. And so you see these narratives come back. And one reason I really, really enjoy reading about early American history is I feel a similar sense. And these African nations and these Caribbean nations that achieved independence in the 1960s, basically, have only had 40 years of trying to chart their own destiny. And to judge them already so early, I think, is not really particularly fair when it took America 100 years to really, you know, start nailing what it was on the global scene. I think we've got another 50 years before we can, you know, maybe stop worrying so much.
And we didn't have to deal so much with the racial issues that right. a lot of emerging post-colonial nations are dealing with as well. So
exactly, which adds
we had a step up, you know, in some senses.
That, yes, yes.
Right.
Definitely, definitely.
But do you see this as something that, since inherently going out into space is kind of a colonial narrative in the first place, do you see sure. colonialism as something that science fiction and or fantasy authors are becoming more aware of, the fact that their narratives are colonial?
Yeah, well, I mean, we live in the year 2010, so I think there's a lot more awareness. There's a lot more pushback, too. A lot of, I mean, we're seeing right now online, you'll see those explosions every once in a while where everyone's, you know, gets upset and says, stop thinking so much. And I think that's a real shame. I mean, if the only purpose of fiction or literature or entertainment was only to entertain, then we'd all just make Transformers 2 over and over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
At some point, there is an added aspect to the nature of what we're doing that is not just pure entertainment, and there should be some depth to what we're doing. And so there's nothing wrong with thinking about what we're doing a little bit. And I think in terms of, you know, we're trying to construct a narrative of the future, why not, you know, think a little bit outside of the box? What will future, you know, contact be like? It's really useful to me to look at first contact scenarios that happened in the past, because I actually think that, you know, if we do encounter another alien race, you know, that whole, you know, technology giving you an edge, that whole interaction between two different groups, there are many different ways that it went down in the past. You know, you know, when you're in high school, you read all about the sort of, you know, destruction of, you know, the conquistadors. And yet, you know, there are many more native groups surviving in South America than they are in North America.
Right.
You know, and so those are two very different historical situations. And you look at sort of the Maori in New Zealand, and you look at how Thailand is one of those nations that was never, ever particularly colonized and has charted its own sort of direction and path throughout history. And so there are lots of lessons to be learned about what a future might look like in terms of, you know, this impact of a first contact or an attempted colonization. And one of the things I thought is that it would be really interesting to bring more of the past into the future in terms of those narratives. So I've always been really interested in sort of how the Spanish and you know, South America happened. And so actually a lot of my ideas for the Xenowealth universe are basically built on that whole first encounter, and that, you know, with taking the Western nations and making them aliens, basically. And yeah, future Earth sort of being overwhelmed by, you know, an alien intelligence that is corporate, because that's what basically founded the, you know, Cortez went out to find gold. So, you know, when you have corporate aliens showing up, one thing we always forget and that I find interesting in reading is that, you know, there were attempts by, you know, both the church and state to sort of protect the Native Americans of South America. They were just ignored by the guys on the ground and the corporations on the ground for the most part. And then it kind of became institutionalized over time and it got worse. But in the very beginning, there's this sort of conflicted attempt by power structures to say, like, okay, well, we're going to go do this. We're going to go grab these resources. We're going to grab this land, but we can't just run around killing off people. like we're plan- like you guys are planning to do. So don't do that. Okay, yeah, sure, we won't do that. And then they show up and do that. So it you know, knowing corporations that we have around today, it just sort of, to me, would be a natural progression to have, you know, alien corporate raiders, you know, basically saying, hey, we'll give, you know, we'd like to buy the moon and we'll give you a couple spaceships for it. And, you know, and so we're like, okay, that sounds like a good deal to us, you know, and we do it. And then once they have the moon, they're like, you know, okay, well, you're not using the Antarctic, you know, we'd like to buy that off you. And then some strange alien disease wipes out, you know, the bulk of Europe. And so they kind of go, well, you're not using it anyway, so we'll just move in there too.
The subtle corporate takeover.
Right. And then it's the thing we tend to forget too is how long it took, you know.
Right.
It took like 200 or 300 years for that entire process, 200 years for that entire process of colonization to take place. And 200 years is a long time. So
yeah.
You know, trying to play that out in the future, we always do these instant battles. But, you know, it's probably more a case of like, oh, well, you know, the aliens took over Bulgaria, you know, and we don't really pay much attention to them, so we'll let them have it, you know. And then like 20 years from now, it's like, and they're edging into like France, but we don't care about them, cheesy surrender monkeys that they are. So we'll just kind of ignore it. And then one day the aliens are in Canada and you're going like, whoa, dude.
Oh, come on. Let's be honest. Who cares about Canada?
Hey.
Well, you know, you know, from a lot of, you know, a lot of Americans wouldn't. They would just be sort of like, well, that's exactly. A bummer, you know.
Right.
I don't know. I think we would
They
be
don't even
very
have
concerned.
An army. But they don't count, you know. But they're on our doorstep. That would be the terrifying part.
That's the thing. Well, yeah. I think that's the narrative that would get sold, is they're now right next door to us. I think you'd be very concerned. Like, it's over in Europe. No big deal.
Right, right. But it's so these are very different narratives than I think the ones we've seen. So these are the things I just kind of obsess about mildly, you know. And but of course it always comes down to trying to tell an entertaining story. And I think the reason these alternate narratives could be interesting is, one, they could teach us a lot about different ways in which these cultural interactions have happened. And two, it gets you to research the past and learn a lot more about what really happened, which is always interesting to me. And three, I think it's just purely as a writer, there's a tremendous amount of conflict and gray and stories that are very fascinating. And that really makes story interesting. And so I think it just makes our stories more interesting if you can kind of depart from the usual and do something a little bit more original.
Oh, I agree. Actually, I have a random question now, because we're talking about all of this. I just did my master's defense, and one of my professors on my committee brought up, in relation to your work, something I had said in my conclusion about it being really rosy and sort of picturesque about how other groups, like Caribbean groups or other sort of third world is not the right term, but other third world groups would join us at in the stars. And I'm curious whether he seemed very cynical about it. Do you have that sort of same cynicism, or do you think that in maybe 100 years, or that there will be more that there'll be more people from non-Western and non-China places going into space?
Sure. I mean, I don't know who your professor is, but I mean, it is a case of where there's a future to be made and a future to be had, hopefully all of Earth will participate in it. You know, one problem I've always had with general space opera is that everyone in it is often white. Mm-hmm. And as one of my friends said, like, the only thing that bugged them about some of the space opera TV they watched was like, where are all the other people? Was there some like massive, you know, genocide that happened that only left white people, and then they went out into space? Like, what's the backstory there that only white people seem to be in spaceships? And so, yeah, I have a tremendous amount of hope for humanity, and I'm really always encouraged by Martin Luther King's statement that the curve of history bends towards justice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a quote that really, you know, comforts me when things look rough, when, you know, things look chaotic and times are tough, is that, you know, if you take a moment to step back. We're so much luckier than our ancestors ever were. This is a very amazing period of history, and we're working to make it better. And yes, there are setbacks, but, you know, it's a good time to be alive. And I know that sounds very Pollyanna-ish, but it's what I've come around to over my life. And I think part of that's because I've made a progression in my life from, you know, being extraordinarily poor to being well off. And so that kind of maybe colors my filters a bit, but, I think there's a place, you know. I wrote my story Toy Planes to sort of kind of talk about that. And there are, you know, African nations testing rockets that have put satellites in orbit so that they can have better remote imaging, you know, to take a look at their lands. There is an Indian space program. There's, there are people who will, you know, now that particularly access to space looks like it might become privatized, then all that means is whoever has the money can go. And there is money in places other than the Western world. So there will be the ability for a small nation to say, well, here's a few million dollars for us to put an astronaut into space. And if you play that out, you know, a couple hundred years, I think space will be diverse just because now we have a educational culture that is fairly diverse. A lot of people are getting advanced degrees. And so the more people you see in engineering that are of diverse backgrounds, the more the more we become globalized, the more people shuffle around, the more I think that the future will be sort of global. I think in the past, in the 1950s and 60s, you're looking at America and you're looking at Russia, and they're putting their, you know, square-jawed Caucasian-looking people into space. Go team. But I think now it's kind of changed, you know, and now we've got, like, you know, India's like, I would like to buy a, you know, spot on the next, you know, Russian launch for an Indian astronaut, or, you know, Japan has sent some astronauts up there. So I think I think space is for us all. And I think I get blowback on this because I have a future that's filled with people of all sorts of different backgrounds. And I get a lot of, well, only Westerners, only people that are basically of Caucasian descent have the engineering and technical prowess to get into space. So therefore only they will be in space.
That's a lie.
And I really reject that. I mean, basically I will call that racist. People are always upset whenever you say, like, that's racist. They're like, I'm not a racist. I'm a nice guy. Well, you may be a nice guy, but it has nothing to do with whether you're racist or not. And what you said was that you believe that one particular group of people has innate capabilities. And we know that's not true, you know? And so there are people of all different nationalities that, you know, work on the tool sets that are required to put people in space. And so I think, you know, as time goes by, it's going to be quite a diverse place. And I'm really, you know, I'm hopeful about that. And I think it'll be a good thing because there are tremendous opportunities that will happen for mankind out in space. I think it'll be great when we can move industry maybe off of Earth, because it, you know, we'd like to have more nature and more people and more living space. You know, if you could ever move heavy industry into orbit where you could, you know, slingshot hazardous waste off to the sun, or, you know, beam the power that's needed back down to the Earth. That's to me, it sounds like a compelling, you know, and even more beautiful future.
Yeah.
I have to interrupt you real quick, Sean. Sorry.
Okay.
Quick question, because at one point, I mean, you're saying that the future he envisions is a little bit rosy, and he's, you know, Tobias is talking about how it is a little bit rosy, but there's actually a comment, and maybe I'm totally misunderstanding a line in Ragamuffin when Nishara says that we were an experiment. You know, we were allowed to go here as an experiment, and, you know, they still controlled space, but we had the planets, which I didn't see as a rosy future at all.
Well, those novels are not rosy at all. Those novels are...
I mean, beyond just the yeah, okay.
Yeah, that is a future. I mean, that's not me looking at, you know, what's down the road in 50 years. That's right. You know, there's plenty to be scared about down the road in 50 years, but, you know, we've come so far in 50 years that I tend to be, like I said, a bit of a Pollyanna, and you know, sort of I have two friends. I have Paolo Bacigalupi is a really good friend of mine who I admire greatly. And you know, you read his stuff and he's a lot more worried about the future than I am. And I have a friend, Carl Schrader, who's a lot more fascinated by all the really cool things we can do in the future. And I sit somewhere between them. And there's, you know, one's kind of like the one voice on one shoulder and the other is the other voice. And I love talking to both of them because I end up walking away very confused. But for the books, Crystal Rain and Ragamuffin and Sly Mongoose, I was particularly trying to display some of the ins and outs of what damages colonialism can wreak. And so in that sense, all of humanity in general in those three books are basically colonized by alien races that believe that they have basically alien man's burden, that they arrived, we weren't very advanced, and so they basically started telling us what to do and forcing us to do what they wanted. And they believe that we're a protectorate of theirs. But from our perspective, free will, destiny, our own ability to manage our own governments has been taken away because they just don't have the patience for it. And so what I was trying to show was that, you know, because like in the one area, you know, humans live on a reservation. They're only allowed to stay in one area. And you have to apply for a pass just to leave that area. Because who knows what trouble humans will get into if they can just walk wherever they please. And that's sort of – I mean that comes out of history, human history, and ghettos and forcible, you know, for, you know, walled off places like, you know, the South America – South Africa, sorry. And reading about those and you know, I want to talk about those things. And so in one sense, my science fiction is not really truly science fiction. It's kind of historical fiction because what I'm doing is taking these things that really have happened and making a metaphor out of them by making the aliens the sort of Western nations. And they, you know, some of my aliens spout Kipling in summary, basically. And which, you know, confuses people of mine who occasionally read it and go, but he was right. Why are the bad guys saying these things? And so, you know, it was just an attempt to sort of fictionalize these situations that have happened as a result of colonialism in the form of a space opera adventure. Right. And just to get people to kind of think about some of these things a little bit as I played with them. And yeah, so that's gritty. It's dark. Like, you know, the opening of Ragamuffin is one person's march out of a reservation, quite literally, and being on the run as everyone, you know, starts to hunt her down. And in, you know, Sly Mongoose, it's I read a lot about, you know, what nations were going through right after they achieved independence and how they were trying to survive, you know, hostile larger nations trying to make them, you know, screw up so that they could justify reinvading them, and how even like, you know, nations that have achieved independence from a colonial group fight with each other, you know, and that's just a price of allowing people to have, you know, to have free will and run their own affairs. And so those were all the things I was trying to explore in those books and will explore as I continue writing them.
And I recommend reading the full sequence because when you get to Sly Mongoose,
I jumped straight into Ragamuffin. So.
Oh no, I know, but like when you get to Sly Mongoose, a lot of that becomes even more complicated by the end of Sly Mongoose, and it's I don't want to ruin it. I'm not going to ruin it because
I
do in my paper, but
at
I don't.
The point that the quote happens, I was unsure if she was specifically referring to the alien races or if she was referring to Western nations in the initial push to colonize space, if in that sense, the Caribbean.
Well, she mentions Earth, so she's talking about Earth, which is I take to mean largely wet. The West
exactly.
Did have that, but then they
cut off. That's what I was – that's where my trepidation in terms of the translation of that was, as I wasn't sure if he was talking about the Western nations or the aliens, you know, which colonizer space was she referring to? And in both senses, it's a very difficult position for the Ragamuffins. So,
yeah, well, it seems like they both were doing the same thing, though, because the aliens kind of semi do the same. Like you can kind of have this little space and you can live there, but as soon as you start breaking our rules, it's over.
Right.
You know, and of course, in Ragamuffin, they have the they remove emancipation and they basically say, well, you guys are not listening to anything, and you can't, obviously you just can't handle yourselves, even in these like very contained areas. So we're just going to cut you down until we've got like 8 of you left, and we can manage 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, unless you're Hongguo, and then you'll be okay.
Well, that's, yeah, they sort of working for, you know, even in, you know, an area that's colonized, there are people who work with the colonizers. So
right.
In that case, I was like, that was what that's what they were doing.
Yeah, and it's really great that you do bring in like Etsudo, who is that kind of, he's kind of torn because he's not entirely loyal to the Hongguo, but at the same time, he's like, he doesn't like where Nishara is going with things, and he's sort of, he just wants kind of to be left alone, but he knows he can't do that. So
right.
He's playing the angles as best he can to keep himself from basically being mind wiped.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to go back real quick to something, because I know
sure.
We already talked about it. The myth of the Caribbean as like technologically destitute is, that's the phrase I'm going to use, because that's really the way people think about
the Caribbean
and other third world spaces.
Sure.
And it is so wrong on so many different levels. I mean, yes, there's a lot of truth to say that not a lot of the Caribbean nations have direct involvement in the space industry. Some of them maybe are like, they build things for other space industries, but they're not doing a lot of launches on their own. But at the same time, a lot of those nations that are part of the UN are ratifying various space-based things about like space junk or rules of space flight, et cetera, who owns the moon. I'm sure that one's coming up at some point. And they are. A lot of those nations are involved in that. So it's, even though they're not maybe directly involved in sending people into space at this immediate moment, they are very much interested in that, or at least they seem to be based on their record in the UN.
Sure. Well, it's a case of this. Like, you know, when you say the Caribbean countries, most Caribbean countries have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So it's kind of like saying that because a county in Ohio hasn't launched a man into outer space, that they're not technologically solid. You know, on one hand, we do have to realize that these are small little islands, you know, that aren't connected to each other. And so there's only so much you can do within that context. But, you know, as far as this idea that, yeah, the developing world is technologically inept, it's a case of like, perceptions can be really off there. I was telling someone that the rate of cell phone distribution in Africa is higher than it is out here in Ohio, and they got really upset with me, and they said, that can't be right. And I'm like, yeah, but it is. Like, you can't say I reject that reality.
It's, right.
That's, they sell more cell phones there than here because they didn't have a very good landline infrastructure, and so cell phones have taken off because you can power a cell phone using solar power. You don't need the landlines. You just need to set up the infrastructure of towers. And so mobile banking has taken off there in a big way in various places. And so there are these things that are being done that are happening, you know, whether people want to realize them or not. And it's a, you know, there is technology happening, and it is being adopted. I was down in Barbados not too long ago, and you know, I was using my iPhone and getting online from free Wi-Fi and, you know, seeing cable TV just like I was here in Ohio. You know, it really wasn't that different.
Wi-Fi and cable in Barbados. What?
Right, you know? Yeah, it's not, you know, it's like when I told people, when I first arrived here in the States and I told people I was from the Caribbean, they were like, well, do you like wear grass skirts or like what? You know? And it's
really?
Like, yeah, seriously.
That's
yeah.
Gosh.
But I suppose that's Ohio for you. No offense.
Yeah, I don't know. So there's a lot of ignorance out there. And you know, there's a lot of information that we have to parse through in daily life. So to some extent I do know that a lot of people don't pay attention outside of their immediate borders, but yeah, it does mean that a lot of people just have no idea. And so you do have to fight some of these assumptions that there is nothing going on there in terms of innovation. On the other hand, I mean, like I said, most of these Caribbean nations only achieved independence in like the 1960s. So, you know, their economies and their centers of innovation and whatnot have only been running, you know, at full tilt for the past like 30 or 40 years. You know, and it's only been my generation that these things have been happening. And there's this fact of the matter of one thing we're learning about how innovation and industry work and whatnot is that having a lot of people within close traveling distance of each other helps, which is why, you know, when you have somewhere like the US with all these like major cities that are connected and a great highway system, you have this tremendous amount of energy and ability there. But the islands, I mean, they're spread, you know, there's a lot of water between them. They're small. There's not a lot of natural resources. And so there is a cap due to the very natural environment that means that, again, it's not, you know, these aren't countries of like millions and millions of people with some exceptions. You know, Grenada is, I think, 200, 300,000 people. So it's the size of like a county here in Ohio. When I was in St. Thomas, that was 100,000 people to 150,000 people. Again, I currently live in a county of 150,000 people or 100,000 people. And I have to say that, like, you know, it's almost better to compare a county to a small Caribbean nation than a whole country. It's not necessarily useful to compare like all of the U.S. to Grenada because it kind of doesn't make sense, apples and oranges, so to speak. And that prevents, you know, a certain amount of, you know, you need a certain population base to draw X number of engineers and X number of whatevers to put together, you know, a space program or a, you know, and so that does, I think, impact the islands somewhat negatively, as well as the fact that there is, and I still read a lot of the newspapers and blogs of people who are back in the Caribbean, and there's always this worry about a brain drain, which is just because there's so many more opportunities in a major Western city or a major U.S. city, a lot of people from the Caribbean leave when they graduate and when they get older and leave the islands and head up to New York or Atlanta or mm-hmm. London to make their fortune and don't go back. And so what that is a continual sort of loss of talent.
Yeah.
And that's something that has to be figured out by the islands.
And well, what's interesting about that too is that the United States these days is functioning, and some parts of the United States are functioning with the same fear of brain drain to India, which has a much larger sure. manufacturing base these days, you know, and whatnot. So it's not like the United States is because we've lost so much manufacturing, and since the islands just they don't have the space or the number of people to have that manufacturing base, which often drives the innovation and the need for the creative specialties. You know, if you don't have that, then it's not going to happen on a broad basis.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Sure. I'm very intrigued by some of the parallels between the sort of very rural and post-Rust Belt slumped Midwest that I live in now and
right.
the islands I came from. I was talking to one of the frustrations we had in the islands was when you'd have a mega hotel corporation basically drop down into the islands. And the problem with that is they would always pitch to the local politicians that we're going to create some jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everyone would get kind of excited and there'd be some construction jobs for the year that it was being built. And then there would be, you know, you could go be a waiter or you could go be, you know, a bus boy or a taxi driver for the hotel. And so there would be some jobs created and the tourists would come in and stay at the hotel. But that hotel, the entity that built the hotel, sucks that money out. And so it doesn't become right. a place where, I mean, tourism is a major industry in the Caribbean, obviously, but those large corporate entities are kind of like these wormholes that get built mm-hmm. on the right. island. And so that money doesn't necessarily have a chance to circulate around as much as if it were a local business that did that. And so when, you know, like we get excited when like a McDonald's comes into the Caribbean I remember in St. Thomas, you know, like when Wendy's and McDonald's were starting to open up, yay, exciting, you know, and we got excited when, you know, like a Kmart came in, you know, and there are good reasons to be excited about it. But the problem is, again, Kmart in wherever Kmart's located in the U.S., they send that money back up to Kmart headquarters. They don't
right.
send it to, you know, Charlotte Amalie headquarters. And it was really interesting to move here to the rural Midwest where, basically, I came in after all of the main streets were decimated by large chain stores.
Yeah.
And I got, you know, I got to hear locals complaining about that. And I thought, wow, this is a very similar problem that, that people are facing.
Yeah.
And the distance problem, too. I mean, I live where I have to drive about 2 or 3 hours to anything interesting. And so that puts a dampener on running into people who have expertise in assembling a, you know, technical endeavor and for interesting ideas to flourish. And there's been this research done that shows that, you know, the spreading people out over a large area basically tends to slow down innovation just by the distance equation. And it's why so much more innovation happens in cities. Random people bump into random people that create more random ideas. And so, I mean, it's interesting that the dilemmas that, that the groups are facing are similar. I see a lot of similarities.
Excellent. Hopefully the internet will level the playing field to an extent.
Exactly.
Because there's more chances for collaboration when you don't have to be in the same space.
Sure, exactly.
Okay, well, I hate to switch topics, but we can't talk for 6 more hours, unfortunately, because you, of course, have got family, and I'm sure you're supposed to be writing or editing or doing something actually more productive than talking to us.
But I'm having fun.
Exactly.
I know, but I'll feel guilty if your novel's late and then the editors are like, you're fired. And then it's like, it's all my fault. No.
Well, I know who to send my editor to then. I'm like, it's all Sean Duke's problem. It's his fault.
I'll move.
I blame him for everything anyway, so it's all good.
Cool. So we have two questions, one that's related to your upcoming novel and one that Jen wanted to ask about boats. So we'll go to the boats first, because that way we can end talking about your latest book.
Well, so, see, if we end with me talking about the book, then it's all justified, right?
Because exactly. Yeah, it's advertising, so it's all good. Okay, so real quick, a few years ago, I live in California, but I came out of my husband was in the Air Force for 6 years. I'm sorry, little backstory. Mm-hmm. My husband was in the Air Force for 6 years, and then we came to California. Colorado, slightly less expensive than California. So when we got out here, we're like, well, where are we going to live? And for a while there, we were seriously considering becoming liveaboards, which is how you were raised. And while we were going through this process, because we have two children, and at the time they were 5 and 6. And to us, that was going to be the biggest hurdle, was raising kids on a boat. It was going to be interesting. And during this process, I was thinking that the coolest book series that I could think of for young adults would be science fiction or fantasy that was based on liveaboards. Is there any chance whatsoever you are ever going to write anything remotely like that? And is it something that, you know, you plan on ever tackling more directly with your work? I mean, it obviously informs how you treat life on spaceships in your other books, but is it something that you ever want to tackle more directly, since it's not a very common experience or lifestyle?
I do. Actually, yes, I do. I do. I have ideas, but nothing that is gelled up to the point where I'm like, ah, this is it. You know? So I try not to force things too much. I touch a little bit more on it in Arctic Rising. I have a lot more, a few more scenes set on boats and live with a character who lives on a boat, but not too much. But it was just my way of easing back in. The problem for me is, like you said, I did grow up on a boat for the most part when I was younger, and I enjoyed the life. I mean, it had its downsides, but I regard it as normal and really enjoyed it. And what happens is, right now I'm living in rural Ohio.
You're landlocked.
I'm landlocked. It's flat. It's dreary. And when I sit down and start writing about living on a boat again, I get horrifically homesick and boat sick.
Not surprised.
And it really actually does a real train wreck on me emotionally. And so it's really not something I actually enjoy doing right now. Because what happens is I end up getting very sort of resentful of my current location. And my current location isn't a bad location. People, you know, give me a lot of crap for living in the Midwest. And don't get me wrong, if I were to strike it rich tomorrow with a New York Times bestseller, you know, that could fuel a move, I would probably move, you know, if my wife, if I could make it so that my wife didn't have to work, I would move to a coast somewhere or a boat, you know. But right. I would want to do it right. I would want to get a really nice boat and make sure it was in good shape because, you know, we always were kind of like boat trash. You know, we were always living hand to mouth on a boat, and that part of it I don't want to go back to because that right. was really tough. And if
that's
I were
tough
to do
on
it
land.
Again,
so.
It's tough on land, yeah. And so if I were to go back to the sea, I would want to do it on a nice boat with enough space for the kids and the right tools. And I don't, you know, I don't want to do it half-assed,
right.
particularly because I'd be dragging my wife who has no boating experience into it. And I would want it to be a good experience for her, and I don't want it to be a bad experience. And I have fears of doing it wrong, you know, and it being a bad experience. So I don't have the ability to go back, and as a result I get really homesick. And so I write about, you know, in Arctic Rising recently I had a few chapters set on basically the boat of my dreams. I had it bookmarked. I had the interior walkthrough in the video and the owner's comments, and that was I used this catamaran as the foundation for this walk, you know, these three chapters. And I have to admit, when I was done with those three chapters, I just wanted to put them behind me because I would just sit there at night and just like click through the pictures of this boat over and over and over again until it was just, you know, just
that's
too
what
much.
I did. That's what I did for about 6 months. And I've never lived on a boat, but I'm from Santa Cruz, California.
Okay.
And so it's a fairly large, you know, boating community around here.
Yeah.
And it just the romantic side of it, you know, I'm totally delusional. In terms of what actually occurs when you're living on a boat, but it was definitely something that we seriously considered, and it is a lifestyle that's fascinating.
Yeah,
it is so rare in the United States, at least.
It's great though. You get to see so much, and basically you live like a multimillionaire, but without the outflow of money. I mean,
right.
If I could set myself up with a nice $100,000 boat in really good shape, fantastic condition, and, you know, put like a saltwater desalinization plant on it and, mm-hmm. you know, a bunch of really nice nowadays with solar panels, you can really just about power the boat off of solar panels and a nice wind generator and, you know, get like a really good deep freeze that runs out, you know, and just take off and explore
it.
And see
that's
things.
That's still our retirement dream, but you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, since you're talking about your latest novel, what I'm hearing is that in February people should buy 10 billion copies of Arctic Rising.
Yes.
Well, you know, you always hope.
All right, so that's our plan.
We have to buy 10 billion. Let's see. You know, I make like a couple dollars a book off of royalties, so we just need 50,000 books to sell. And I can buy that boat. So
done.
I'm saying right here.
Done. All 50,000 I'm buying. I'm not that rich. I don't have that kind of money. I'm a poor grad student. So I guess that brings us really to Arctic Rising, which is coming out from Troll in February again of next year. So basically, I mean, what is it about? And how does it maybe connect to some of the themes and stuff that has sort of appeared in your other work?
Well, this should be an interesting departure for many because it's not space opera. We're doing a near future sort of techno thriller, and in the vein of, you know, like the cyberpunks or you know the other sort of near future SF writers. It's an area I really enjoy, and I've always wanted to tackle. And with Arctic Rising, it came out of the stories I was writing. I wrote this story called Mitigation with Carl Schrader. That was in one of the year's best anthologies and seemed to have been received really well. And it's about what happened when the Arctic ice finally sort of melts enough that there's just a tremendous amount of economic and civilizational activity up there. And I was reading articles about shipping companies, Russian shipping companies and Canadian shipping companies that are now making plans to start using the Northwest Passage for the first time in human history for regular overland Arctic shipping. There's so little ice now in the summers that they're basically banking on being able to open up whole new trade routes. And we had a sailing yacht recently that basically sailed the Northwest Passage. And if you remember anything from like history, it, you know, the Northwest Passage was something that everyone kept trying to find north of Canada and couldn't because it was just all ice. And now it isn't. And there are going to be tremendous amounts of oil and resources that are opened up because you won't have to deal with the ice. There are lots of islands up there. And I just became really fascinated by the fact that I was reading these, that, you know, the biggest hippies in the world are like the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army when it comes to green research and, you know, ice.
It always cracks me up.
Ice forecasting. They have these great environmental studies where they plan for what we will have to do with our Navy in order to create a polar fleet when the ice melts. And they're already starting to worry about this and try to figure out how to budget for it and what, you know, what ships they'll need for that. And there were these open documents that you can read if you poke around the Department of Defense websites that are basically read like near future science fiction. And I thought, this is great. The Department of Defense has done all my research for me. I'm going to download all these PDFs and just read through them and just start taking notes. And what was interesting was as I was planning to write the novel, I'd gone through a period of a delay. My career kind of got delayed for a year and a half there because I got sick. And I used a lot of the time to do some reading. And what was happening was every 6 months, the worst case ice scenarios for the Arctic were changing, and not for the better. Basically, when I started writing about this in 2006, 2007, the worst case scenarios were considered like the worst case. Like, we're just going to throw this in there to have a bottom, you know, a crazy line. Like, you know, maybe there'll be 2/3 of the ice left, and that's just crazy. And by the time I was actually writing the bulk of this novel 3 or 4 years later, the worst case scenarios that I had in my PDFs had been updated so that those were the best case scenarios in just 3 or 4 years in terms of how much ice would be surviving. And when I started writing the novel, no one was saying that there would be no ice at some point. And now that I'm finishing it up and turning it in, my science fictional, oh my gosh, isn't this crazy idea, was what if there was no ice? Like, this stuff accelerates to the point where, like, you know, there's just basically hardly any ice left there. It's for all intents and purposes during the summer, there's no ice. And by the time I was done with the book, I remember I picked up an article from one of the DoD websites that said, you know, it might be interesting to assume no ice by like 2050 or 2040. And I was just like, no, you're kidding me. I was just throwing that out there to be a complete like, oh, you know, this will get people talking and make me seem radical. And by the time I was done writing the damn thing, people were just saying, you know, like, hey, let's just assume no ice for our worst case scenario. So I was like, man, this better get published soon because
suddenly, you know, it's not very,
I was hoping I could generate some headlines by being like, you know, to, you know, science fiction author Tobias Buckell predicts no ice at the North Polar Cap by such and such time. And now, of course, it's a couple articles have done that. So I'm no longer feeling such, you know, so like such a crazy guy. And yeah, so the novel is basically about all the crazy stuff that's happening. There's a group of people who've, you know, built giant refrigeration cables to try and save like the last little bit of North Polar ice cap. And, you know, they've got some polar bears wandering around in a zoo. And there are, you know, people dumping nuclear waste up there. There are people trying to create ways to go back, you know, to reverse global warming. And there's just all this crazy stuff going on in the book. And I just wanted to do something like that and see how people would take it and just do sort of a science fiction techno thriller and just go balls to the wall and have fun with it.
That's fantastic. Your new worst case scenario could be that it's on fire. So
that'll be the sequel. Instead of Arctic Rising, it'll be Arctic on Fire.
They'll put a crazy polar bear on the cover. It'll be like one of those Bind covers, you know, like a CG'd polar bear.
Sure, sure. Oh. But yeah. On fire.
But on fire with like demon eyes.
And here I was thinking that like Antarctic Descending or something would be a cool second title. I think you've got me beat.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if anybody would take that so seriously, though.
I think Antarctic Descending is a little bit more likely.
Or Antarctica Descending, I think, was one of the titles I'd thrown around. But I'm going to wait to see how Arctic Rising does. I've got I'm working on another book that's completely different. I'm kind of having fun not doing anything related to anything else right now. It's a really freeing experience.
Yeah. Well, and it's good, you know, trying new stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, it's good as a writer.
Yeah.
You know,
I do it in short fiction all the time. So now to I'm really happy. I enjoyed doing the Zen of Wealth series, and I'm going to come back to it. You know, and I have two more novels to write in that universe that I have fleshed out and that I would like to write. And then it's done. It's five books is what I want it to be. But what I'm really enjoying is just kind of starting fresh with each book and doing something, you know, a little bit stylistically different, a little bit, you know, character different, a little bit world building different. And it's been really low stress and a lot of fun to not have to be thinking about, oh, what did I write 3 years ago in that first book?
Oh, man. Well, unfortunately, we can't keep talking all day because I have to go to a conference. And unfortunately,
Party
like,
Cooper.
I'm sorry. I planned it out and like, I don't own, I'm one of those weird people that doesn't own a car. So.
And you made me wake up before noon today, which is just so rude.
Well, you're a mom. You're already anyway. But okay, so the new novel is coming out in February, and we should definitely have you back on around when the novel comes out. That'd be really awesome.
I'd be delighted. I'd be even more coherent about what the novel's about because I'm still.
By then.
Yeah, I'm still in the process of rewriting it, so I don't really have my elevator pitch down, right?
Oh, okay. Well, by then you'll have read it so many times, maybe you'll be so tired of it.
That's true. That's usually what happens. Like, can we talk about my next book?
We can do that too. That'd be awesome. And by then I'll have a master's degree in which I've talked behind your back.
There we go. You can say things about me that make me like sound like I'm way smarter than I really was when I wrote the novel.
I don't know. I sound pretty smart, you know? Anyway. Well, thanks so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk to you.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.